Good morning, everyone. Welcome to week 7 of the series called Foundational Principles. Just a couple of housekeeping things first. Those are coming on a bit late. I'll try and remind you later of this again. But today is actually the last of this series. However, we still have 2 weeks left to the term, so next week and the week after, I'm going to be just doing a short 2-week series, which I've called Mindfulness and Relationships. I've been doing a little bit of reading and study on the effect of mindful living to do with relationships, and that's an aspect of mindfulness we haven't sort of explored properly in the past. A very, very important area, and that's what we'll do in the next 2 weeks. So that's mindfulness and relationships next week and the week after. Then we'll take a break and come back with a new series. Also, that's the next 2 weeks. But next week itself, we come to the end and we're going to draw the raffle. So I just wanted to mention something about the raffle before we continue. I just wanted, first of all, want to thank everyone for their support and those who supported us and participated. When we started the raffle this year, which is always a good, an important fundraiser that we do, we were very conscious of the fact that it's a difficult year, and obviously we didn't offer travel tickets this year because that wouldn't be too relevant, but we have the voucher prizes, and we were conscious of the fact that for some people it'll be very difficult, and that's why we made the tickets $50. Many people just kept the same as last year and bought double, and for those that couldn't, that's 100% fine because we perfectly understand that, but we'd really got amazing support, I just want to thank everyone for that. Just to mention, however, that next week, as I said, we're drawing it. And previous years, we often had a goal of trying to sell 613 tickets. 613, of course, the number of mitzvot in the Torah. So we figured this year we'd set ourselves an ambitious goal of double that because it's half the price. And we thought we'd try and sell 1,226 tickets. So we're already at 1,105. We've just got 1 week to go. We've only got 121 to go. So if anyone can help us finish our goal, that would be great. One more week. It's on the website. You can call the office. And then we'll draw it, please God, next week. Okay. So we've been having the series called Foundational Principles based on the book called Witness by Ariel Berger. Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Today's the last one. I have to say, for me, it's been a great journey because there are really some great ideas and thought-provoking insights and questions in the book, and I thought that was amazing. Just also to get an insight into Elie Wiesel's world through the eyes of a student, a close student, was actually quite fascinating. And we talked about many, many topics over the last chapters. We talked about otherness, the concept of otherness, activism, what real memory actually means, and so on and so forth. Last week we talked about the language that is beyond words, like the nigun, the song, the conviction, the stuff that can't be expressed in language and words but can be expressed through that which transcends language, that which is even higher than language. So today I wanted to do the final chapter. When I read it, I realized it's an interesting chapter. It's a bit of a strange chapter, actually, in terms of the book, because it really is just a conclusion. It records some conversations and reflections between the author, Ariel Berger, and Elie Wiesel, his mentor. And it talks about, you know, just Elie Wiesel's last part of his life, his sickness, his ultimate passing away, his funeral, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to take a few things from the chapter because it's very inspiring, but I'm also, with your permission, I'm going to digress a little bit and touch on some of these ideas, but also digress, taking inspiration from the chapter, and talk about a different topic, which we've touched on briefly in previous weeks, but I believe it needs clarity, a topic of clarity, and I'll get to it in a few moments. So, much of the book that we did so far is about learning from experiences, applying it, remembering it properly, making the world a better place, and so on. And some of the themes that's come through in the book is able to do this with confidence, with conviction, with faith, activism, as we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, standing up to evil, standing up to immorality, standing up to intolerance, and so on and so forth, hatred, and etc. And as we said a number of times, it's not about doing it in a way which necessarily will make global changes, but it's about doing it in a way that it will help someone support someone, reach out to someone, change someone, one person at a time. Okay. Now, these are beautiful ideas, beautiful principles. However, it's not so simple. It's not so simple because it's not always easy to reflect and detect or identify what is actually good and what is actually bad, what is moral, what is immoral, what is right or what is wrong, right? It's not always easy because it's not always easy also to know which strategy sometimes to use. What is the appropriate strategy? What is the appropriate response, right? Because I think nowadays particularly, we live in a world that's more confused than ever, I think. Political and personal biases get in the way more than before. The media is very often distorted in opposite directions and has a very strong influence and a very strong impact, right? And it's very easy. We trend in today's society to get very swept up with herd mentality or herd perceptions. Just trends that are sort of popular, beliefs that are popular, and so on and so forth, right? And often we descend into a sort of a mindset which is lack of clarity, gross confusion, and it's just very, very hard. It's actually hard to navigate, even though we might learn and we might understand the basic foundations of wrong and right, but it's just very, very hard to navigate sometimes. And time again, we kind of have this patches of real confusion, I think, which has been happening recently. And what it means is it's time to step back. It's time to step back and reflect, explore, think about right and wrong, think about what's good. Now, in the Jewish context, we achieve this, we do this in a number of ways. First of all, we need to be always conscious of the fact that we have a moral compass. We have the Torah that was given to us, which is our eternal moral compass. That's where we learn the basic values and foundational values, observances, concepts, insights, view on the world, and so on and so forth. The fundamental Jewish belief is that the Torah is not just a response to one aspect of society or one historic glimpse of society, but really it's the blueprint of the universe to begin with, and therefore is eternal in its morality and values, sometimes applied a bit differently from generation to generation, but essentially it's an eternal system, right? So always good to be conscious of that and to study that and explore that. But together with that, there's something which we've talked about many, many times. And that is, we still have to make sure that we don't distort that process. Because it's very easy to study and to misinterpret or be distorted or be mixed in our own personal bias or egocentricity and so on. And therefore, to maintain our objectivity when we navigate the questions and the ethics and the morality of life, identifying what we should stand up for, we shouldn't stand up for, and how we navigate all of that together, we need to do what the Pirkei Avot, what the ethics of the fathers tells us to do, and that is we need to have someone else, a guide, a mentor. Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a mentor. Knei lecha chaver, acquire friends. We need to be people that we bounce things off. We need to have mentors that guide us, that the number one qualification of that mentor is that he's not or she's not us, meaning they can be objective, they can guide us, they can enlighten us to things we might not be seeing through the fog of our subjectivity. Which, by the way, is something that comes out in a very interesting and deep way in this chapter, in the book. I'll just share with you some. So, he talks about some of the last visits that he had with Elie Wiesel. And he says, and I'll read it to you, he says in one of the visits, he tells me of his work to build a coalition of governments, of government leaders, willing to call out the Iranian president Ahmadinejad for the Holocaust denial and his repeated calls for Israel's destruction. Then he says a very important thing, which is so true. He says, we have learned to listen when someone uses such language, but it's always difficult to mobilize meaningful responses. He sighs and he says, we know so little. The older I get, the more I realize how little we know about ourselves and why we do the things that we do. To which the author says, what do you mean? And he answers, he says, we know so much about how hatred works. We know it starts with words, with symbols, and it ends with killing. We know this, and we have seen it over, but we sit and watch as it happens yet again. Why? Because we are busy with our lives, because politicians want to win elections, etc., etc. And he says, I used to have more patience for all of that. And then suddenly the author says, he changes the subject and he says to me, tell me, what is new with you? And he goes into inquiries about what's happening with his students. And he asks him a couple of questions, and then he says, his next question surprises me. And he says, who is your mashgiach? Now it's interesting, he uses that language, mashgiach. It comes from some yeshivot. Now just in case you're confused, mashgiach normally people think is a kashrut supervisor, like a mashgiach in a restaurant or in a catering firm, right? But the mashgiach word, mashgiach, actually means a supervisor. And he says it's a term used in traditional Jewish schools. It's a kind of spiritual supervisor, a guide with whom students discuss their personal issues. So in some places it's called a mashpia, a rebbe, a guide, a mentor, a mashgiach. So anyway, so he uses the term mashgiach. So Elie Wiesel asks him, he says, who is your mashgiach? Meaning, you know, you're facing different issues in life, you're making decisions, career decisions, family decisions, ethical decisions, spiritual decisions. Who is your mashgiach? And he thinks for a moment, the author says, I think for a moment, and I said to him, well, you are. He considered Elie Wiesel his mentor. Professor Wiesel says, now you need to develop your own inner mashgiach. Now this is very profound, and I'll tell you why. Because both things are true. We each need, doesn't matter what age we are, how old we are, and how experienced we are, we each need a physical mashgiach. We need someone else besides us. But at the same time, when we have mentors, or we have people that guide us, what we shouldn't do is develop a dependence on them. Because the human design and God's mission is very much about internalizing our connection, internalizing our goal, and starting to work things out on our own. Not to be constantly dependent on every step of the way to ask someone else. In other words, it comes together with studying. Studying, building a perspective, building a value system, building a vision, a sense of clarity of how to view the world and how to view these decisions, and then to once in a while check in with the mashgiach, check in with the supervisor to make sure we're on the right track, or something very that's more gray, or something that comes up that where we fear that our own subjectivity is getting in the way, our own ego is disturbing us or distracting us. That's when we check in with someone who's a mentor, but not someone who we ask questions because the whole idea is to work ourselves. The whole idea is personal growth. The whole idea is to work out, obviously using a system higher than us, but it's to work out ourselves what to do. Which, by the way, is very, very fascinatingly expressed in a terminology that's used in the Torah just last week, in last week's weekly portion. I'm sure I've shared this with you before, but God tells Moses to communicate to Aaron the mitzvah of kindling the menorah, the candelabra, each day in the temple. And the term he uses, which becomes the name of last week's parasha actually, is beha'alotcha et haneirot. Ha'alotcha literally means when you bring up, like aliyah, to bring up. When you bring up the flames, in other words, when you kindle the candelabra. And the commentators comment on this because it's an unusual language. We are used to that when we use language of kindling something, we normally use the term lehadlik. When you write Shabbat candles, you say lehadlik ner Shabbat. When we light Chanukah candles, we say lehadlik ner Chanukah. Hadlaka, lehadlik is to kindle. So why does the Torah use the term here, b'ha'alotcha? So Rashi, the great famous commentator, already quotes from others, and he says, because it was part of the instruction, right? The Torah tells Aaron that when he kindles the candelabra in the temple, he has to hold the match there long enough for the flame, shetehei shalhevet oleh me'eleha, that the flame should come up, the flame should elevate itself, the flame should burn as flames do, pointing upwards on its own. It needs to burn on its own, which means it's an instruction for the person kindling the menorah that they have to hold it there long enough until it starts to burn on its own. But that phrase, shalhevet oleh me'eleha, the flame burning on its own, has been used time and time again for the influence we have over others, or the influence we receive from others, or educational principles of how we teach people and inspire them. That yes, there are people that have to kindle others. There are people that have to inspire others. There are people that have to bring up others, so to speak. But it has to always be shalhevet olem elea. The goal is for the flame to burn on its own and not to be constantly dependent on the match. So these two parts of the question, on the one hand, Elie Wiesel asks Rabbi Berger, Ariel Berger says, who's your mashkiach? And then when he says it's you, he says you need to find your inner mashkiach. And both things are true. We all have to have someone that we could turn to. We all have to have that match, that guide, that mentor that we can check into once in a while. But at the same time, we need to build with clarity through looking at things properly, through exploring things properly, through studying and building that whole value perception, that we start to burn on our own and we start to get a good sense, a clear sense of good and good and bad, evil and good things and so on. Which leads me to what I want to actually digress with a little bit. Because I want to share with you a couple of thoughts and put it all together and build something that I've spoken to you about before, but build that sort of tool of how do we gain clarity? And how do we build that inner mashkiach, that inner mentor? And to do that, I'm going to digress, and I actually did this with a small group of men the other night, looking at what's been happening in the world in the last few weeks, especially in other parts of the world, especially in America, the world has descended into complete chaos. And the chaos has brought with it tremendous confusion. And as Jews, the way I always understand it in the Jewish context, is when something happens out of the ordinary, or people have questions, or people are confused and not sure what's right and wrong anymore, we need to turn to our moral compass. We need to explore what is the view. What is the Torah view? What is the Jewish view? That's what I do. That's what I try and do, right? So there was the acts of racism, there's protests, there's riots, there's vandalism, there's calls to defund the police, there's the whole issue of the police, the effectiveness of police being called into question. Lots of stuff is on the table, right? So I want to go through with you just a couple of perspectives, and I'm happy to discuss it with you afterwards. What your thoughts are. It'll be interesting to see. But I want to just share with you what I think is a worthwhile perspective building up. Starting off with a little story that I've shared with you before, but the story is of the rabbi in the shtetl, two people came for a din Torah with him. I don't know, one said the other person owes him money, or whatever the argument, whatever the conflict was. And the rabbi in the shtetl was conducting this litigation, and he turns to the one guy after he heard everything, and he says, "You're right. You're right." And he turns to the other guy, and he says, "You're right. You're right." And they go away, and afterwards, his wife, who is listening to the proceedings from behind the door, she happened to overhear, and says to him, "I don't understand. How can two people be right? What do you just do? How do you make both of them right?" So he turns to her and he says, "You're also right." So it's a little shtetl anecdote, but it highlights an important thing. To understand what is right, sometimes we also have to internalize and understand that there's more than one right. And more than one rights can live together. And we need to understand how that works. So we'll come back to this. But I want to first go through four or five just isolated topics, right? And share with you what I believe the Jewish view is, and then put them all together. Spare with me, because I hope you'll understand the picture afterwards. So the first thing is, let's talk about racism. I mean, it's a no-brainer. Racism in Torah, in the Jewish sources, is absolutely evil, right? What does that mean from a Jewish perspective? Torah actually does not believe everyone is exactly the same, meaning, in terms of roles, we know that the Jewish view is that different people have different missions, different people have different roles. Jewish people have a distinct role, other people have different roles. Within the Jewish people itself, there are Kohanim, there's Levi'im, there's Yisraelim. Everyone is different, everyone has different missions. We're coming up in 2 weeks' time to the Parsha of Korach, where Korach claimed that he was a great promoted Levi, a Levite, and yet he decided he wants to be a high priest. And Moses told him, "You can't." And in fact, according to Rashi, Moses told him that, "I also want to be a high priest, but I can't. I'm Moses, I'm the leader, but I can't because I'm not a Kohen." Finished. That's it. There are different roles. But roles are terms of how everyone's different mission of how they contribute to the overall role and mission of the world. But in terms of the intrinsic value of a person, the Torah and the Talmud is completely clear, crystal clear, that everyone is absolutely equal in terms of value. Why? Because a person, we know, every person, every human being on the world, in the world, was created, B'Tselem Elohim, created with the image of God. What does that mean? What does it mean to be created in the image of God? So it means lots of different things. It means we have a soul, we have a spark of divinity within us. But it means more than that. Kabbalistically, it actually means that the shape of the human body represents a godly imprint. And I'm not going to go into it now with great complexity, but suffice to say, we've done many, many times, we've talked about the 10 powers of creation, God's 10 powers. The 3 intellectual, the 7 emotional, and so on. Chochma, Bina, Da'at, Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, and so on. And we are taught Kabbalistically that the human body, not just the soul, the body, is an imprint, represents the 10 Sefirot. There are 3 parts of the brain representing Chochma, Bina, and Da'at. The right hand and the left hand is Chesed and Gevura. The abdomen is Tiferet. 2 legs are Netzach and Hod. The genitals are Yesod. And then there's the whole Malchut, the receiver, the giver, and so on and so forth. So every human being, and this Pirkei Avot tells us very clearly, that there's a preciousness, there's a uniqueness, there's a beauty that is in with every single human being, just by being human, just by being a creation of God, and being created with the imprint, the branding of God's imprint, that makes the life of every single human being on this planet of infinite value. And therefore, any compromise or senseless act of violence against any human, no matter who the human might be, is, from the Torah's perspective, any not only senseless act of violence, physical violence, whether it's physical violence or even emotional violence, humiliation, embarrassing, compromising emotional trauma. The Talmud is full of examples where that's absolutely crystal clear that all of that is evil because it compromises the basic intrinsic value and dignity of every human, of any human being. And that's why when we have a story about a policeman, and there could be bad policemen, who kills a black man in a senseless act of violence, that's just pure racism and pure violence and a senseless act, hatred, and it's evil. Nothing to talk about. It's completely evil, right? That's clear. Nothing, there's no interpretation of that. And incidentally, it actually makes no difference how good or bad that person was. I'm not quite sure why it's so relevant to build the victim up to be the greatest human being. Maybe he wasn't the greatest human being, but that's irrelevant. Because the intrinsic value of a human being has nothing to do with their accomplishments, has nothing to do with their compliance with the law, it has nothing to do with anything. It has to do with just being human. So that's the one principle I think we need to be very clear about that. And we also, connected to that is the realization and the consciousness and the awareness and the acknowledgement, I would argue, and I think everyone would agree, that racism is not dead. It's alive and well. It's alive and well all over the world and manifests itself in many, many different ways, which is very unfortunate. That's something Elie Wiesel was trying to fight against, made some headway. The world has made some headway, but it's nowhere near over. It is alive and well. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, while we need to fight evil and stand up with evil, we don't fight evil with evil. We don't fight evil with hatred. We don't right a wrong by another wrong. And that's something we need to, that's equally true, right? So vandalism, looting shops and so on and so forth is equally wrong. The third thing, which is an interesting thing, and I'm going to share this with you because it's fascinating. We've heard calls all over the world in the last few days to defund the police. So I thought I'd share with you a bit of perspective. I mean, it's a ridiculous notion anyway, but I want to share with you a bit of perspective from a Torah point, from a Jewish point of view. What is the Jewish view on law enforcement? Now, by the way, with the full acknowledgement that not every policeman is a saint, absolutely. They are definitely in every profession. Not every doctor is a saint. Not every policeman is a saint. Not every anything like. So there's always bad apples. But let's just talk about law enforcement in general. What is the Jewish view? And also, what is the Jewish view on the consequence of crime? In other words, imprisonment, which is a big discussion. So let's just separate those two issues. And I just thought I'd share with you because to me it's also a fascinating concept. So the Torah views, and we see it in many, many sources, law enforcement to be a critical necessity. Now, being a critical necessity does not mean that it's the ideal. It means it's just a necessity. Let me explain. So in Pirkei Avot, it tells us the ethics of the fathers, it says, which is, by the way, the source, the origin of the prayer that many synagogues make on Shabbat. I'm sure you've heard it. They make a prayer for the country, the governor general, the prime minister, whatever the case is. Why? Because in Pirkei Avot, it says that have a mitpalel, one should pray for the welfare of the regime of the country, because they are responsible for law enforcement, and if not for them, people would devour each other. Going back to the Torah at the very, very beginning, in Dvarim and Deuteronomy, we have one of the 613 mitzvot is to appoint shoftim v'shotrim, judges and police officers. What's the role? Judges are scholars, judges are legislators. They're the people that interpret the law. They're the people that lay down the law. They're the people that adjudicate between people who are litigating with each other, and so on and so forth. And that's what they do. They establish the law. They give counsel. But then there's the officer, so to speak, the shoter, the policeman, to enforce the law, right? So we see that Torah asks us to do that. Now, what's fascinating is the following. Every single day, obviously we don't have the justice system that the Torah justice system. We don't have a Sanhedrin anymore. We don't have that original biblical justice system. But interestingly enough, every day in our Amidah, we do pray for the return of the system. We pray for that perfect system that God laid down in the Torah. But if you look carefully at the words, you'll see something fascinating. When we pray, one of the blessings of the Amidah says the following: Hashiva shofteinu kevarishana. Please, God, return our judges as it was in the beginning when we had those amazing spiritual and scholarly judges in times, in biblical times. Hashiva shofteinu, bring back those judges. Kevarishana, like it was in the beginning. V'yo'atsayich kevatchila, and bring back those wise counselors as it was in the beginning. We ask God to return the system. But there's one omission that we make. We don't ask God to return the policeman. Why not? So the commentaries explain, because law enforcement is a critical necessity, but not an ideal. And therefore, it will exist until Mashiach comes, because it has to exist. But when Mashiach arrives, there won't be law enforcement. Why? Because the ultimate ideal state of a human being, and this is an important thing to understand, we need to work towards it. The ultimate ideal state of a human being is to internalize morality, to internalize compliance, to want to do the right thing. So we need judges, we need legislators when Mashiach comes to interpret the law, to answer questions, to interpret things that come up. And if there's a difference of opinion for them to tell us who's right and who's wrong, we need that. But in the ultimate state of the universe existence, when we no longer will have the temptation or the attraction to evil, we won't need law enforcement. So when we pray for Mashiach, we pray for the removal of the police force. However, that's only when Mashiach comes. Up until Mashiach comes, fundamental to our belief system is that there's good and bad in the world. That the way God designed the world, the universe, is there should be good and bad, there should be good temptations and bad temptations. We have what's called a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. We have a good inclination and a bad inclination. And therefore we have temptation. A part of the process is to overcome the struggle, to overcome the temptation, to have self-control, but it's not always easy. And therefore part of the human function is in an inbuilt human weakness that we sometimes are drawn to do the wrong thing if we're not stopped externally. Yes, we should work towards internalizing that goal, not needing anyone to enforce the law with us and to tell us what to do, because we should want to do it on our own volition. But the reality of society is that that's not going to happen until Mashiach comes. Until Mashiach comes, we are taught there will be good and bad in the world. There will be the struggle. The struggle between the two. And therefore, that struggle comes with temptation and lack of self-control and the temptation to do the wrong thing. And without law enforcement, it will descend into anarchy and it will descend into evil behavior. So, law enforcement is not the ideal, but it's critical until Mashiach comes. Now, is the justice system therefore perfect? No, obviously not. Should we do other things to build up more internalized compliance? The answer is obviously yes. So I say, defunding the police is a terrible idea, obviously. It's a stupid idea on any level. What we should be doing is finding resources somewhere else and putting more money, not taking it away from law enforcement, but putting more finances, putting more resources into education, into helping people, into supporting people to get on their 2 feet on their own, to be internalized, to have internal values, internal morality. That's for sure. When we say, is law enforcement perfect? No, it's not. Is everyone in the law enforcement a good guy? Absolutely not. 95% of them are fantastic people. People that put their life on the line every day to keep us safe. But there's some problems. And also the system is not perfect. Part of the imperfection of the system, and I just want to share this with you because I think it's interesting, is the view on punishment and the view of imprisonment, incarceration. We know that it's not working. Not here and not in the States. In the States, the rate of reoffending, recidivism, is about 65%. Over here, it's about 45%. That's not good news. Why? So what's fascinating is that the Jewish view, the Torah actually does not support prison as a punishment. Very fascinating. The Torah does have other punishments. The Torah has financial fines. The Torah has capital punishments for very severe offenses. Didn't happen very often, but it does accept that concept as a possibility sometimes. Very rarely, but sometimes. But the reason that the Torah does not, with two small exceptions, which I'll show with you in a second, the reason that the Torah does not accept prison is because prison is about taking someone's freedom away completely. When they lose not just one freedom of moving around, but they lose lots of freedoms. And essentially it's an attack on the dignity of the human being, on the humanness of the human being. And therefore people do not progress, for most of the time, do not progress in incarceration. They become worse. And sometimes they reoffend for all sorts of psychological and emotional reasons. In other words, it's not a process of rehabilitation. Now, in the Torah we find two instances where something similar to prison is applied. One is in the case of a violent, aggressive criminal who the court assesses and sees as just a complete threat to society. Therefore, there's no choice. You have to lock him up or her up because they could go and harm other people. And the second is a very fascinating concept we find in the Torah that we don't find, I don't think, in most cultures. It's a system called Arei Miklat, the cities of refuge. And the cities of refuge was a system made for people who, I guess you would call it today, are guilty of manslaughter. I mean to say it's normally called unintentional murder, but it's a case of unintentional murder where had the person be fully responsible, they would have avoided the accident and they would have been more responsible. So we're talking about a person who's considered reckless, not intentional, didn't intentionally murder, but he considered reckless to a certain point. And in the Torah, that person is sent away for a period of time into exile to a city called the Arei Miklat, the cities of refuge. They had to be away from their family, they had to be stuck there, their movements restricted, almost like a quarantine, lockdown sort of thing, until a certain time, and they were restricted that way. However, that's a sort of an imprisonment. However, it was a very rehabilitative imprisonment. Why? There was someone else who lived in those cities. There were 42 such cities in Israel. And in biblical times, when the Jews came into Israel, all the tribes were given a portion of land to farm, except for one tribe, the tribe of Levi. They were the spiritual servants. They were the clergy of the Jewish community. Therefore, they weren't given a portion of the land of Israel to farm because they weren't farmers. They worked in the temple. They taught knowledge. They taught Torah to the masses. So where did they live? There was a sort of like a housing commission set up for them. Where? In the very same cities. In the very same cities, there was Levim. So you had these 42 cities where two types of people lived there. Unintentional murderers and great Levim. Why? Because that was the point. The point was that the spirituality of the Levites should be there to influence, to rehabilitate, to inspire the person who was there to atone for his sin. Because the Torah views everyone as having hope. Even a criminal has hope. They made a mistake, but their potential is still there. Their soul is still there. Their rehabilitative potential is still there. So there's a lot of work to do in terms of modern society's response to crime, because it clearly isn't working in many, many parts of the world. But that doesn't mean that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need a justice system, and we, in fact, one of the seven Noahide laws, very interesting. You know, the non-Jews are given what we call seven Noahide laws. Not, can't steal, can't murder. One of the seven Noahide laws that we believe in for all humanity is for every country or every community to set up a justice system. Is it perfect today? No, a lot of pitfalls, but it's a necessity. Two more concepts, then we'll put it all together. The Jewish view on protests. An interesting thing. What is the Jewish view on protests? So the answer is the Torah condones protest. Peaceful protest. Why? We have, on all levels, we have a mitzvah in the Torah to stand up to things which are not good. Even on an individual level, to reprimand someone who we think we can influence from doing something wrong. Now there's all kinds of conditions. It's got to be done peacefully. It's got to be done respectfully. It's got to be done in a way where it's effective. If it's not effective, it's not worth doing. So one always has to assess that. But the intrinsic concept of a protest, which is really activism and standing up to what is bad and evil, as we talked about a few weeks ago, silence is not good. Silence is evil. So therefore, protest, in essence, when there's change comes about through protest, but peaceful protest, right? And the fifth thing I wanted to touch on before I put it all together for you, and then end off with going back to the book, is another concept altogether. And it's about responsibility to others. Meaning, when we do things, one of the fundamental principles of Torah is that we are not created alone. We're not created in isolation. And we cannot do things, even if they're good things, just considering our own emotional and spiritual welfare. But we have to do things considering the effect it has on others. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, educationally, spiritually, and so on and so forth. So how does it all come together? Now, I've shared this with you before, but it's something that's really bothering me over the last few weeks, and I'm going to just talk about it now for a little bit. You've heard me talk about in previous times about the pendulum syndrome, where for some reason people in society, most people, find it very, very hard to hold different opposite extremes together at the same time. They want to go either to the one way, one direction or the other, the right or the left. So what we're facing today, and this is becoming actually much worse, we're facing the radicalization of society in either direction, which is becoming very divisive and actually very dangerous. So on the one hand, in current events, you'll have people who stand up for racism, but then it's okay to loot and okay to have protests and defund the police and just throw it all out. Dangerous. You have people on the other hand who are against all of it, including not acknowledging the systematic racism that does exist in the world. It's a fact. Now, where does this all come from? It comes from the following. And I'm just going to go back to a very simplistic analogy that I've told you many, many, many times. It goes back to the three primary personality drivers within the person. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet. So Chesed is that giving, flexible, loving personality, tolerant personality. Gvura is the more disciplined, strict, sometimes judging or harsh sort of personality. And then Tiferet is the harmony between the two. So you've heard me give the very simplistic analogy very, very often about the guy walking in the street and sees a homeless person who's clearly hungry. He comes over to you and he says to you, "I'm really hungry. Could you please give me $20 to buy food?" And there's a really legitimate suspicion that he might take the $20 and buy a substance which is dangerous for him. So you have three responses. The chesed person just says, "Yes, of course, take the money." He can't say no. Can't bear to say no. Can't bear to see suffering. The gvurah person who sees that it's dangerous to give the $20 says, "Get lost." What does the tiferet person do? Combines the two. He says, "No, I'm not going to give you $20, but come across the street. Let's go to that store and I'll buy you a sandwich." Now, again, I mean, obviously the scenario can play out in so many different ways. I'm just giving you a very simple analogy so we get the point. What's the concept behind this? And here comes the punchline, which is really important. The concept behind this is this. Most of us are drawn to either chesed or gvura generally in life. In other words, we're drawn to a certain personality, a certain disposition. When we respond to the world through the prism of our personality, then we're not looking for the truth, we're looking to be us. And effective living, meaningful living, purposeful living means that every so often we have to go beyond us. So go back to the story. The chesed person gives the $20 because they're just projecting themselves. They can't bear to see someone suffer. They can't bear to say no, so here's the $20. The Gevurah person is a lot stricter, doesn't care to say no, doesn't care what happens to the person. Again, it's the person themselves, it's their personality coming through. The Tiferet person says the following, and this is very, very important. The Tiferet person says, it's not about what I want. It's not about my personality. It's not about what I feel. It's not about the way I see things. It's about what is right and what is true. Forget about my chesed. Forget about my gevurah. Forget about what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm excited about. Let me take a step back and look at the situation rather than look at me. Look at what's needed to help, what's needed to be moral and good, rather than what I want to do. And this is the crux of it all. When we're very egocentric, when we live in a very me world as we do today, more and more people are slipping into a trap of just being themselves. Meaning not looking at what is moral or true, but just starting point is me. It's an I world, me and myself. And therefore everything is going to flow from me. And therefore I will post-rationalize, I will build systems, I'll build values, I'll build rationalizations, I'll have convictions, I'll be passionate, I'll be enthusiastic, all about the starting point. The starting point is me. And therefore you become radicalized in either direction. Depending on what the you is, the you becomes extreme. And that's why people can't hold two opposite truths at the same time. Because that's a very difficult thing to do. That means going beyond yourself. So either you have one belief and that's good and everything gets built on that because that fits into your narrative or your agenda, whatever the case is. Or you go to an opposite belief. Or you switch sides, but it's only one side. I can only handle one side at a time. That's me. But to live a moral life, to gain clarity, to check in with a mentor, to have the inbuilt mashgiach, the inbuilt mentor, so that we can see things properly and look at morality properly, we need to develop a sense of leaving ourselves behind. We need to develop a sense of going beyond ourselves and saying it's not about me, it's about what is the right thing. And if you focus on what the truth is and the right thing is, it becomes easier then to join many, many different truths together, and it doesn't matter, even they seem to be contradictory, but we're looking for the truth, we're not looking to just project and broadcast our own feelings. So when that comes, it's called the Kava Emsa'i, the middle path. Middle path means it's not about chesed or gevurah, it's about looking at what is needed, looking at what is effective, looking at what is true, looking about what is moral. So what happens is, racism bad? Absolutely racism is bad. Does it need to be called out? Yes, it does need to be called out. Is it tragic when it happens? It's evil when it happens. Is it okay to loot stores and break windows? No, it's not. Is it okay to shoot policemen in revenge? No, it's not. And it's equally as evil. And just as we protest the racism, we should protest the brutality against police in the same way. Because they're both evil. We need to get our hand right there. They're both evil. Because, yes, people are angry, but the Torah is very clear, our Jewish values are very clear, that no matter how upset you are, no matter how tempted you are, no matter what kind of victim you are, no matter what your background is and your education and your traumatic past, no matter what that is, we always have to have self-control. We do not have permission to use evil to fight evil. We do not have permission to, unless it's a specific self-defense issue, or it's a specific moral type of aggression which the Torah calls for, like we did a few weeks ago where Eri Wiesel said in four that sometimes it's moral to go to war to stop evil. But otherwise, we don't have that permission, that luxury to fight evil with evil, no matter what anger we're feeling. To be angry is legitimate. To be upset is legitimate. But your response has to be equally moral to the morality that you're trying to fight for. You can't fight for a morality using immoral means. They don't go together. Are protests good? Yes, they're good. Does that mean it's okay to go to a protest during a coronavirus where you could put other people in health danger? Absolutely not. We have, one of the truths is, we said before, is moral responsibility to others. We can't just say, well, I have such an important cause, so it's a more important cause than your cause. That is not true. Maybe they need to have made a Zoom protest of 10,000 people in a different way. But if there's a health crisis, you need to listen to the officials. It's wrong to protest and put other people's health in. It's right to protest, but it's wrong to protest and put other people's health in danger. Did that particular policeman who kill George Floyd? Was he evil? Yes. Was he a bad person? Yes. Should he be brought to justice? Yes. Does that mean all policemen are bad? Does that mean we should defund the police, law enforcement? No. We need to hold all these truths in our head at the same time, because they're all true. They're all true as long as we're coming from the truth, not from ourselves. When we're coming from our own emotions, when we're coming from our own anger, when we're coming from our own biases, then we can't combine truths. So I just wanted to bring that in because I thought it's pretty relevant what we're going through now. And I think that's the crux of it, is about looking at the truth, not looking at our own biases, and to be able to hold those many great truths together. But it goes back to the whole concept of what is in this book, which is about activism and standing up for hatred and not being silent, which absolutely has to happen, but it has to be done in the correct way, in the moral way, in the way which is looking for, not just looking to stand up, but looking to do it in the moral and sensible and effective and true way. I want to just end off with one really important thing, going back to the end of the book. One of the ways to make sure that we make ourselves and the environment a better place, right? Which is really the goal of all of this. One of the ways to make ourselves have moral clarity and to achieve all those things we've been discussing throughout the last number of weeks, there's another very important component, and that is to believe in ourselves and to believe in others. To believe that deep down, with all the nonsense, there's an inner spark. We all have an inner spark. In other words, the bottom line is we all want to do the right thing. We all want meaning. We all want purpose, right? Our instinctive focus is intact. Our basic spark is intact, both with ourselves and both with others. So one of the things to achieve, all of these things that we've been talking about in the book, including the discussion today, to achieve moral clarity and to go beyond ourselves and all of that, is to understand that we should never despair. That as much as the outer layers of ourselves or other people seem so problematic and seem so bad and lost, it's not lost. Because deep down, our intrinsic identity, our true value remains intact. The real us is always okay. The real others is always okay. Right? That's the foundation identity of who we are. Who is the real us? Not the mistakes we make. Not the mistakes others make. Not the things bad that we do, not the things bad that other people do. Right? And you know what? It comes out very strongly towards the end of the book. It's a very interesting thing. In this book, towards the end, he discusses the rise of fame of Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, to further his cause, became a very famous individual. Politicians, and then later on, he teamed up with a lot of celebrities. Right? Now, he welcomed this only because, not because he was looking for fame, but he was looking to promote his cause, to help others and help have others help him promote his cause, to stand up for evil, to stand up for racism, to stand up for hatred, and to fight it in the world. So he did that, right? In 2006, he and Oprah Winfrey traveled to Auschwitz together, right? Why? Because she had just made Night for her book club, and propelling Wiesel's first book with a new translation, and you know, became a very, very famous book then. They became two close friends, and so on and so forth. And then the author says the following. He says, although he spent time with political leaders and later movie stars who he was happy to recruit to promote causes dear to his heart, he was more invested in his message than in his image. And listen to the next line. He told me often that he still saw himself as the yeshiva boy from Siget. That was his original religious town where he learnt in yeshiva and in cheder from before the war. Those foundational years, the years that instilled with him his basic Jewish values and his basic emunah, the basic faith. And he said, especially during public moments, that's where he saw himself when the cameras flashed and flicked. He would always see himself, who is the real he? The real he is his foundation. The real him is his faith. The real him is the values instilled to him in him as a child when he studied in yeshiva, that yeshiva bacha, that yeshiva boy from the town of Siget. This comes out again, it comes out later, when the author of the book visits Elie Wiesel in hospital after his last surgery. And Elie Wiesel, during the conversation, he says to him, he says, you know, during my recovery, I asked the nurse to move all the IVs from my left arm, to my left, to my right arm, as soon as possible, so I could put on tefillin. So he asks Elie Wiesel, he says, that mean you have to get every single IV again? I ask, he says, yes, it wasn't so painful, and I really needed to wear tefillin as soon as I could. And then in brackets, the author says, I remember that he had told me years earlier that the very first thing he asked for after the war was a pair of tefillin. And I'm bringing this in because at critical moments, I'm not sure if Elie Wiesel put on tefillin every day. That's not relevant. And we spoke about this before. After the war, he certainly struggled. He struggled with his faith. He struggled with religious observance. And he went back and forth. And he talks about it. And he's very open about it, which is perfectly understandable. But what we do see is, in those critical moments, what came out and what shone out is who he really was. And with all his fame, his essence was that strength and that faith, that emunah that we talked about a few weeks ago that came from within. His childhood foundation, his emunah, his love of a mitzvah, with all the things that came and all the things that he experienced, what drove him at the end of the day, that foundational drive, was that spark, that inner essence of who he really was, and that drove essentially everything that he lived for and everything that he lived for and everything that he stood for and everything that he activated for. And I think that's an amazing lesson. I think as we navigate through life, using our experiences to further good, using the power of leadership to inspire other people, using the power of activism to influence one person at a time, we need to realize we all go through ups and downs, but the ups and downs are only superficial. What really is deep down, at the very foundation, at the very core of our essence, is that soul and that faith, that determination, that resilience, and that confidence. And once in a while, when things are ups down or up, we just need to activate it. We need to reconnect to it, to give us that extra strength to keep going and to never give up trying and to keep doing one person at a time, one thing at a time, and to bring growth, spirituality, goodness, and improvement to ourselves and to the world around us. So that ends the series. And I want to, again, first of all, thank you for coming with me on this journey of this book. It was really fascinating for me. I just want to remind everyone, especially those that came on a bit late, that this is the end of the series. However, we have two more weeks. So we're doing a mini series the next 2 weeks called Mindfulness and Relationships, looking at how mindful living affects relationships. And that's a very fascinating concept. And also just to remind you that next week we are going to draw the raffle. At the end of the Zoom session, I'll have a few people with me here to do it properly, and then we'll continue for one more week, and then have a break, and then come back with a new series. So again, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day, everyone, and have a great week. See you next week or before. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rabbi.
All the best.